Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Womenhood and International Relations podcast. I'm your host, Natalia Bonilla. And for today's episode, we have a special guest with us, Dr. L. Ayu Saraswati, professor in women, gender, and sexuality studies at the University of Hawaii, and author of the new book, Scarred: A Feminist Journey Through Pain. Dr. Ayu has also published a previous book called Seeing Beauty, Sensing Race in Transnational Indonesia. Dr. Ayu, thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Thank you so much for allowing me to share the space with you, and thank you for the work that you've been doing. And I was listening to your podcast and I was, wow, this is such a powerful program. So thank you. Thank you for the work and for allowing me to be here.
We are so, so thankful to you as well, because your work is very inspiring. And I think it could help a lot of the feminist researchers, activists, and scholars that are trying to move the needle forward, not only for their communities and their nations, but also for themselves, because we are living in very interesting times where pain and suffering is part of the daily international news cycle. But somehow we don't see the connection to feminism, or to understanding better how pain works and how it's connected to our evolution as humans and as states and systems. So we will like to start this conversation with you today, asking a very simple question. What inspired you to write Scarred, A Feminist Journey?
So I first write the book because I wanted to process and learn for myself, how can I live with pain differently? Because at the time I thought, well, this was not a way to live. I had chronic illnesses, anxiety, depression. I was unhappy with things going on in my life, professionally, personally, you name it. So at the time I felt like, oh, I just need to get out of here. I didn't plan to travel to 20 countries in 1 year, but that's what I ended up doing. And along the way, I learned a few practices that helped me live with pain differently. So then I wanted to write a book because I want to share these practices. And at the same time, I want to invite the readers to find their own way to live with pain differently. And when I say differently, I mean in a way that is more life-sustaining, more humane, and more feminist. And by that, I mean a more social justice-oriented way.
One of the first explorations in your book that I really found very important is to understand that pain is more than this dual notion that we have in the Western world. How do you define pain?
There are different ways I talk about pain in the book. And let me just start by talking about the two definitions that I have in the book. And then, during the interview, we can talk about other ones. But the first one that's important is that pain is not the condition of the wound, but pain is the perception of the wound. Because it is perception, then if we change how we perceive, we will then experience pain differently. In other words, then we can live with pain in a more nourishing way. Yes, we feel pain, but we can feel nourished at the same time. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that pain is never only personal. Even though it may feel like that, it's never only personal. Pain is also political, social, and structural. So because pain is also structural and political, we therefore need to change and challenge it at these levels as well. So this is why it's important to consider pain from a feminist perspective, because we can then analyze pain from a gender and social justice perspective, not just personal level. Because ultimately, the goal is to change that structure that creates pain to begin with, and that disconnects us from our community and the collectives.
I really resonate with these points. One of them is that, pain is very uncomfortable to feel. And I don't know if this is preconditioned or, our societies are not meant to help us handle or move through this pain. Do people relate to pain, or do they seek to hide it?
So in our culture right now, we are obsessed with getting rid of pain. They tell us, go get workshop, attend this, take this medicine, and do all that you can to avoid, get rid of, manage pain. And what this book is about, I'm not even saying that if you do these things, you will be pain-free. Healing is not even the goal in this book. The goal in this book is, because pain is going to be here anyway, how can we live with it in a way that still nourishes us, in a way that would allow us to still connect with ourselves and with others, right? And so because if the goal is just to get rid of pain, then we really are going to dismiss and erase this very important tool in our lives, because pain is actually important and helpful. If we don't have pain, let's say an example that I always like to use is if we are cooking and we put our hand somewhere in there, like there's fire, hot things, and we don't feel pain, then our hand will stay there and we don't remove our hand. And it will hurt us. So pain, in the book, I actually talk about pain as integral part of the living body. So for as long as you're alive, I know this is not the news that everybody wants to hear, but for as long as you're alive, pain will be there with us to help us guide our ways so that we actually are safer and can live life in a better way.
I find that very interesting, because we see pain as evil, as something bad, as something that we don't want to be seen or experience, or, you know, have it for a long time, because then our self-perception could be like we may be damaged or something's wrong with us if we linger or hold on to pain. And connecting with what you said about pain being a political aspect as well, seeing that collectives and communities are at times, and depending on the country, on the context, this may vary to different degrees, but holding and sustaining different levels of pain in their daily lives that go unnoticed, or, you know, fall into the radar or transmute into violence. I do consider this point important to reflect upon. We are living in systems, be it capitalism or be it communists or dictatorships or whatever, systems that inflict different types of wounds, not just one of one day and that's it. But if you try to heal one specific wound, the next day there will be a reminder of another wound, and how much pain is being inflicted from different levels, structural, direct, or cultural, maybe on a daily basis. I think that many people don't see this topic as connected to international relations, but it is very intrinsic. And I would like to invite you to share more about these connections.
So pain is a very powerful tool to get others to submit to our power. And this is exactly what you're talking about. It could be happening at the level of the nation state, at the government. It could happen at the level of our peers. And this is why bullies are trying to hurt others, because that's what they're doing. They could be bullies at the peer level or at the national level or at the international level. But what they're trying to do is to hurt us emotionally, verbally, financially, physically, politically, right? Because then once you're in pain, you will submit to what they are wanting you to do. So this is why it's important also. And in the book, well, first of all, it's important to first to realize that. So then when somebody is trying to hurt us, or we perceive that, we recognize that, the first thing is, what do we do? right? We recognize, oh, this is what they're trying to do, is to make us submit to their power. That's the first thing. But second of all, then, how can we move beyond that? How can we challenge that? At a day-to-day level, I talk about in the book a practice that I call feminist enchantment. And this practice is about creating moments, or like what, you know, moments of enchantment. But this is kind of like those magical moments when you see in the book, I talk about the Northern Lights, or it could be watching sunset. It could also be just being at the Rose Garden that I was talking about, or it could be walking somewhere and seeing something so beautiful that in that split second, it could be 2 seconds, 10 seconds. Like I said, these are moments, right? You completely forget about all the pain. But then when you remember at that moment, there is something that connects you with your own body. We feel alive inside in that moment. When we look at something so beautiful, so enchanting, there is something inside us that feel alive. And I don't know about you, but for me, a lot of the time, when I feel pain, I try to numb the pain. That means I try not to feel it. That means I disconnect myself from the feelings that I have in my body. I try to disconnect myself from the body. And so when we feel enchanted in that moment, when something is alive in us and we feel reconnected with our body, we feel that, oh, okay, we can do this. We can be reminded of our own power, our connection to ourselves, and then hopefully our connection to the community, to the resources. How can we ask this? Okay, if the bully is attacking us, are there the community, the collective that can help us? How can we be playful, be curious to figure out their resources? Because a lot of the time when bully or like somebody's hurting us, we feel so deflated, we feel so defeated that we're just like, okay, we'll just stay, we'll just do this. I'll do whatever you want. Right. And so that's why it's important. And that's why I call it feminist enchantment, because this is not about feeling enchanted. Oh, I forget about this world. I just want to escape this world. This world is too painful. No, no, no. We feel enchanted so that we can have the energy to challenge the structure, to challenge the power, not just, oh, well, we'll just, you know, forget about this world, forget about the pain, not that.
There's these parallels of conversation that I'm finding here and connecting dots with the work in international relations, like, for example, how people may be numbing pain at political levels, world leaders that are taking these important decisions, whether to engage in war or whether to push a nuclear button, etc., like whether they may be numbing pain towards what the decision may be, or the actions or the foreign policies, or etc., but also on their own personal lives, which we may not have access or know much about, depending on the person. But then also a parallel to the populations themselves, how they may be numb in the sense of if they take the armed struggle or the armed fight, and be like, let's fight one another with another country or another ethnic group, etc., how they may be holding back or moving without recognizing the pain that they're inflicting and that it's being inflicted towards them. And also the other side of the population that has perhaps, or another type of population that has receive so much levels of suffering and pain that they don't have the will to fight back, and they just submit and they just surrender. I don't know. I see this more clear now that you were speaking, like how we may be contributing to more if we don't know how to process or properly define it as such. In that sense, what are some misconceptions that you think are common in terms of understanding pain and its relation to feminism?
So the first thing is that pain is often used in feminism as a way to construct victimhood, and from that point to then seek justice. And that is important, and that has served its purposes. So I don't want to dismiss that. I also want to be clear that there have been feminist scholars before me who have pointed out that this will actually make us be more invested in being victims. And we don't want victimhood to be the thing that unifies us. We want it to be our power that unifies us, right? So how can then we recognize the pain, but not construct a victimhood out of it? And yet at the same time, we still want to change and challenge that structure that creates that pain. Does that make sense? Like, that's very different. We're not invested in us staying victims. So that's the first thing. The second misconception, I mentioned this before, but pain is often framed as something that is personal. It happens to you. It happens to that individual. And this is what I want to challenge by pointing out that pain is political, social, and structural. And not only that, in my book, Scarred, I exposed the problem with how we handle pain under this neoliberal political economy. Here's the thing about neoliberalism. Neoliberalism teaches us that if you're in pain, then you are responsible to deal with it. You need to change yourself. You need to do something about it so you stop feeling the pain. Now, if you hear this and think, well, but that's how it should be, then it actually is proof that neoliberalism is so pervasive in our lives that this has been the norm for how to deal with pain. So what I propose in the book is that we consider pain as political and as a site for structural transformation. I also propose that we need to reframe healing as a feminist practice that is found outside of the neoliberal framework. This means that when we are in pain, we want to heal not only ourselves, but also our culture, our community, and our collective pain. So all the four practices that I talk about in the book, it's not about the person, but it's how the personal collides with the political, how the personal is also about the political, how what we do in the personal level is directly related to the political structure and how we can change and challenge that. So it's not just about changing ourselves.
I resonate with much of what you're saying, because in the international relations, we have this theory, and that's something that we have studied a lot in our podcast on feminist theory applied to IR, which one of the main topics is how the personal is political and how the personal is international. Like, there's no distinction. Like, whatever you experience in your personal level can create a ripple effect to your community and worldwide, if we go to those levels, and vice versa. What happens worldwide eventually will affect you. We are living in an interconnected world, but somehow, as you were explaining this misconception of pain being only personal and only a thing that people, individuals need to handle and figure it out and heal it, what do you think causes this disconnection of people not seeing that, hey, like, if I work through this pain, I don't have to do it alone, I can do it with others, and it can be political too?
Yeah, so it is exactly going back to that notion of pain is political, social, and structural, and I should add cultural. And that is the reason why we perceive pain in a certain way. In other words, if you grew up in certain culture, you will have a way of understanding and dealing with pain in a certain way. And that is why I mentioned that, because right now we live in a neoliberal political economy, and this has been going on not only in 2020, this has been going on for decades. And some people or some theorists would go back to 1970s. Some people would say 1990s is more of the peak time of that. But in other words, these political or ideology, as well as culture, really shape why we perceive pain as something that is personal. And that is why pointing to neoliberalism, that is really about personal responsibility, right? Because neoliberalism is about deregulation, it's about transferring. Authors or like theorists use the word power, but you know, I think it's not so much about power, but maybe responsibility, the transferring of power from the state to individuals, right? And so because of this ideology, because of the culture we live in, that is why people understand it in this way. And that's why I try to challenge it. That's why I try to let's change this culture, let's change this ideology so that we can think of pain, not just at the personal level, because then when we only think of it as personal, then we only find ways to deal with it at a personal level. And no matter how you change your mind, diet yourself, do whatever you can to your own body, for as long as you don't change, or like I should say, as long as there is no change happening at the structural level, then that pain will continue to manifest in the exact same way, no matter how hard you change your life individually.
There may be some of our listeners that may be wondering at this point, okay, so if pain needs to be also dealt with or transformed collectively, what if we are living in societies where collective programs or community programs are heavily politicized? Like, for example, oh, that means that you are pro this party or pro left or pro right. And then suddenly someone labels you because now we are in cancel culture as well. Like a lot of fear of expressing what we think and stand by. And, you know, maybe wondering, okay, so how is it possible to start working pain or seeing pain political, but also collectively, without fear of backlash? Because sometimes we associate politics only to political parties and not as in, hey, we are humans, political. How to navigate these waters for those that may be wondering, how is that possible? What tools can they find in your book?
So the first thing that we have to always remember is divide and conquer is a very efficient colonial strategy. So when we remember this, then we can always remember that, yes, of course, this is what those in power want us to do and behave and to be afraid of, making that sort of connection. And they will try all they can for us to be divided and therefore conquered. So a lot of the time, one of the tools that I we talked about in my own classrooms with my students is when they go to Thanksgiving dinner or Christmas dinner with their families, where there could be all these conversations about politics. And at this time in the United States, families are divided and strongly. Some have stopped talking to their parents because of what's happening, because of the political stance. One tool that we talk a lot about in the class is to ask questions. So rather than just state our opinion, we ask to learn. So where do you, how do you get to think that way, right? So when we ask, you know, how do you get to that? Oh, what do you think of this? Do you think this? So instead of like, I think blah, 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 I said, well, do you think, right? Because even posing something as a question rather than a statement of criticism of something that can feel like an attack, because the moment we say something and the person feel being that they are being attacked and they will suddenly be defensive, and then nobody's going to learn anything because I'm going to be defensive, you're going to be defensive, I know how I think, you're where is this conversation going? So I think that's the first step, is to do that. And sometimes it may not be possible to work with that family member, with that community, and that's okay. We start with where we are, create the community where we are, where we can, and hopefully that will become bigger and bigger and bigger. And someday it'll be big enough that our parents see that on TV and said, oh, yeah, that makes sense, because it's a scholar, it's somebody they know, it's somebody else who said it to them, then it registers differently in their head and they listen, right? But that's okay. We start where we are, we start where we can.
Your research is also about an embodied experience. You were writing this book while traveling. You did take 1 year off to travel to 20 countries, more than 20 countries. Could you share with us a specific experience from your travels that deeply influenced your understanding of pain with a feminist framework?
Well, this is actually a tough one to answer, not only because there were so many experiences and I have to think one experience, but also that it wasn't that I experienced something specifically during my travel and then that moment made me have a different understanding about pain. But because it took quite some time after I experience it, I reflect on it and I reflect on it throughout my travels and I did my research on it and then to finally articulate my thoughts. So in other words, it may not seem like, oh, this happens. And then, in other words, the connection may not feel or seem as straightforward, but I'm going to try anyway. So let's go to my experience of attending a women's only retreat in Costa Rica. When I was there, I actually had a great experience. Loved it. Love everyone there. I would definitely go back. And then when I was able to think about it more reflectively and deeply, so this retreat, just like any other retreat, actually teaches women to shift from a victim to a victor subjectivity, right? And that is really helpful for me, for all women. So there is nothing bad I would like to say about this, and I hope people don't think of it that way, okay? But that experience there helps me see how we all have been trained and disciplined how to perceive. And this way of perceiving often causes us pain. So I'm just going to give you an example so that it becomes clear what I meant. In this culture, women are taught that to be beautiful is to be slim and skinny. So when we look at ourselves in the mirror and we just gain weight, we may feel upset and sad about our body. Now, neoliberalism teaches us that we need to change our body. We should go on diet, exercise. We also need to change our attitude to have positive thinking. I love myself. I am beautiful. You are beautiful. We're all beautiful. But here's the thing. What I just said to you, this positive thinking, is actually a perfect example of what I call in the book, docile perception. Docile perception. That is when we perceive and the way that we are taught how to perceive and this way of perceiving make us docile. Because in this case, what we do is we just change our perception and we feel good about ourselves, but we don't change the structure that creates the sexist, racist, ableist, fat-shaming beauty ideal that creates that pain to begin with. So instead, I propose that we practice what I call defiant perception. This is a way of perceiving that defies, that resists, that challenges how we are taught to perceive. So instead of simply saying, I'm beautiful, we actually want to challenge the beauty standard itself by asking, where did I learn to perceive in this way? Who benefits when I think like this? How can I actually challenge this? So in other words, when we practice defiant perception, we refuse to be disciplined in how we ought to perceive. We don't buy into the way they want us to perceive our body or ourselves. And what I would like to clarify is not to say, oh, don't say I'm beautiful. I'm not saying that. By all means, if that mantra works for you, you get up. And it is true that in a culture, I'm a woman of color. I grew up in a culture that tells me you need to have a light skin color. And the word pretty in Indonesia, cantik, that is not something that people would assign to me because I didn't have a light skin color. So to even claim, if I want to claim I am beautiful, in this culture that teaches women that women like me with like darker skin are not beautiful, I want to claim that, I'm challenging that, that is okay too. that is fine, that works. But at the same time, it's not about just changing our perception. How can we also challenge that culture that tells women that if you have dark skin, you are ugly? And what I did is I wrote the book. My first book is called Seeing Beauty, Sensing Race in Transnational Indonesia, where I literally talk about colorism in Indonesia, and particularly about the skin whitening, right? So it's not just about me claiming, but also writing a book. And again, I'm not saying everybody should write a book, but the next time you see someone, at the very least, in my culture, people say, oh, why you get so dark? What did you do? Or, oh, you're pretty. Your skin is lighter now. At the very least, let's not say that, right? And so I'm not saying go write a book or have a podcast, you know, no need. People work in, you know, different ways. But what I'm saying is that let's change not only ourselves, but also our community and the collective.
Being born and raised in Puerto Rico, which is still a colony of the United States, I relate in some ways to a few of your experiences in one of the countries where you lived, that was Hawaii. You are born and raised in Indonesia, but you took a couple of years and lived in Hawaii, the islands. And the perception of homeland was carrying with you some sort of pain. And that's something that I find very relatable to my experience as well, something that I've covered in the podcast with the Burden of the Colonial Mindset podcast series, which I never found the right wording until I read it in your book, which was, you know, like seeing our homeland or this perception of homeland as a site of wounding. I do feel like this opportunity that we may have had, or some of our listeners have had, to perhaps travel abroad and, you know, seek some other references of possible lives where you do not feel out of place, or places or countries where you feel more at home or more belonging than in your own home culture or where you were born and raised. Maybe some of the experiences. However, there may be other listeners who do not have access to travel, or who may be stuck in a specific place and maybe listening to this and be like, okay, I don't have the money, I don't have the resources or the opportunities to go abroad and have that opportunity to experience something different. For those that are staying in their quote-unquote sites of wounding or primary sites of wounding, what message will you give, or any reflections on how they can start transforming pain?
Thank you for this question, because this is a very important question that allows me to clarify that the four practices to live with pain differently that I offer in the book actually do not involve traveling at all. Again, just to clarify, traveling matters in my thinking and coming up with these four practices. But none of these four practices actually involve traveling. So if you'd like me to talk about the four practices now, I'd be happy to. But
yeah, please do.
So these four practices, the first practice is to practice defiant perception. And since I just talked about it, I won't go over it again. And the second practice is about working with the body, but without the story. So when we feel pain, and we've read this in other books as well, we tend to store it in the body. Now, to transform the pain, we need to work with the body, obviously. But here's the thing. A lot of the time, when we work with the body, we also work with the story. So what I'm proposing is, can we work with the body, but without the story? Because when we work with the story, we get trapped in our own story. So bypass the story and work with the body directly. Here's an easy example that anybody can do next time. The next time you cry, cry without the story. So you cry, 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 cry. But instead of crying and saying, oh my God, why did this happen to me? I'm such a fool for trusting this person or whatever, which just happened to me anyway. I literally did this just the other day. So even though I wrote the book, I sometimes still forget to practice this. So that's okay. But the minute we realize that, the minute the story comes up, we need to drop it. So I had to do this the other day too. I said like, okay, drop it. Sometimes I use that word literally, just drop it, drop it, drop it. Or sometimes I imagine whatever the thought or the image in my mind to just kind of like become blurry or evaporate. In other words, do what you can to drop the story. And here's the thing, when we just cry, and in the book, I talk about the practice of no mind therapy. And when I actually practice this, there are other emotions and things that are going on in the body that suddenly become resurface, right? Because again, when we bury all those things, right? When we do this practice, we actually allow these other emotions to come up. And when they come up, that's when we can then transform through these emotions or all those pain. So that's the second practice. Work with the body, but without the story. That's the second. The third practice is about practicing feminist enchantment in our daily lives. And I'm just going to talk about this briefly because I did mention it before. It's because that day in, day out, sometimes it's not about bigger things, but simple things like our work environment or things like that sometimes make us feel defeated because whatever that's happening, again, to turn us into submissive worker or whoever it is, right? So what happened when we practice feminist enchantment is that we can then forget about the pain, we feel alive on the inside, and then we want to, because when we feel alive inside, when you're like a child again, right? Childlike, not childish, right? When we are becoming like child again, we're actually curious. Oh, how can you do that? How can we do that? How can I stand up? When we do that, when we become curious, then we're like, oh, how can I live with this pain? Oh, how can I like carry this pain? I actually in the book use the word carry because pain is something that we carry, right? And so how can we carry this differently? Just like when you carry a backpack and then you like hiking for 2 hours and you start to feel, you know, tired. Okay, how can we carry it? Like maybe readjust it differently, maybe do carry the backpack this way. But it's just kind of like that. When we carry pain, and how can we adjust it in a different way? So that's what moments of enchantment allow us to do, is that creating those moments when we can then adjust our backpack or this pain, then we can feel that, oh, this is possible. I can carry this pain. It feels more life-sustaining for us to carry and to continue on. Because what I worry, and I have experienced this too, sometimes the pain and the problem feels so overwhelming. It feels so like too big, too much to handle. Like I can't live like this anymore. And luckily when I felt that way, I felt like I can't live like this. I need to get out of here. But to get out of here, I chose traveling. But sometimes people need to get out of this planet, out of this earth. And that's something that we don't want. Or for some people, that's something that we don't want. So how can we create those moments of enchantment so we feel like, okay, I can do this. We can start again. That's the third practice. The fourth practice is to demand emotional contract. And this is very important because this brings us back to that main point about pain is political. Because like I said, no matter how much you change your perception, you work with your body, you practice feminist enchantment every day, we still need that political and institutional support from our government to help us carry pain in a life-sustaining way. So emotional contract is about democratizing access to well-being. It's about asking, what programs and policies does our government have that can help us carry pain in a more life-sustaining way? Now, in the book, Scarred, I talk about emotional contract at the level of the nation state by examining healthcare policies, paid parental leave, new immigrant programs, and I look at Indonesia, United States, Iceland, and New Zealand. But when we think about emotional contract, I want to be certain that let's not only think about emotional contract at the level of the nation state, but think about it at the level of your workplace, at the level of our family and our friends. So all levels of our lives. So for instance, what are the things that your employer, your workplace provides you with so that you can access that well-being at work? So that when you're in pain, when you're in emotional pain, physical pain, all kinds of pain, that there's something in the structure that help you carry pain in a way that makes you feel like, okay, because I'm not the only person carrying this pain. There are other hands here carrying that pain with me. I feel like I can do this. I can live with pain this way, in this way, in this nourishing way.
In that sense, in the book, you provide some examples as to policies that governments can take in order to prepare and deliver this sustenance.
Life sustaining, yeah, because it sustains our life, right? Because a lot of the time, pain sometimes makes us want to end our life.
Mm-hmm.
So then how can we live with pain in a way that sustains our life? And that's why I call it in a life-sustaining way.
Yeah. So there are examples. Can you provide one? People understand that the governments can actually create programs that can help sustain pain.
The easiest is affordable and accessible healthcare for all. And when I say accessible, affordable healthcare, I also talk about mental healthcare. In the United States, different insurance policies actually say, okay, you get 5 visits a year that is 100% covered. But after that, from 6 to 10, from 6 to, you know, and they all have these different numbers. And how would I be able to have a very stable and happy mental state of being when I can't even access these ways of tools of mental health or therapy? And also, maybe some people tend to move toward something that is not psychology, that is not the kind of therapy that the insurance covers. Again, I grew up in Indonesia, so mental health, it does not always or only mean the kind of therapy that, you know, psychology or psychotherapy or psychiatry. Some people may turn to kind of like shamanism or spiritual healers in a certain way. So, and we know too that these are not covered, and it is not covered because it is hard to regulate. In any case, how can we live in a how can we deal with pain or live with pain in a life-sustaining way when the first thing that you think about after you get out of hospital is, oh, how much is the medical bill going to be? Isn't that going to create more emotional and financial pain in our lives? So that's the first and super basic, super simple. Do we have that? Affordable and accessible healthcare that includes mental health care for all.
We are reaching the end of this interview, and we have two last questions for you. One has to do with the state of the world today. Since 2020, we have seen this emergency of polycrisis, from armed conflicts to religious and cultural wars, to the spread of disinformation and misinformation campaigns, to the use of AI images that distort the views of wars, of hunger or crimes, famines, and elections even. From your perspective, are we witnessing a new era of world pain, or has it always been that way, but just now we are more aware of it?
So we are definitely in an era of intensified pain. For example, with social media, we are more connected to others than before. We can see the pain of others, so we become more aware of it. But also with social media, we can contribute to the pain of others. the simple example is when I read social media and I read people's comments attacking each other, I was really sad about how easy we disregard other people's emotions because we can easily hurt other people with our words. And we have been desensitized to this in some way. And also the technology, obviously, progress, or I don't know if I should use the word progress, because this technology, including the word technology, has advanced in a way that made it easier to wound, to destroy other people or our land. And this is the world that we live in right now. So I definitely agree with you that we live in an era of intensified pain. That means it wasn't, I'm not saying that there was no pain before, but because of the technology, all of these, including social media, right? That there is this intensified pain where the texture, the intensity, the distribution of pain has definitely magnified because of where we are historically and technologically.
There will be some that argue that while this is happening in certain places, contexts, and communities, there are still also a counteracting movement of spiritual awakening, of spiritual and physical healing, of psychological work and counseling work, seeking to provide and protect mental health, emotional health, and physical well-being. And your book is one of these tools that people can have at their disposal, and I think more for this feminist activism work. I noticed that the notion of carrying pain, sometimes if we are not careful as feminists, as scholars, as activists, pain can become part of our identity instead of it being something that we go through or something that we witness. And it is important that we understand those distinctions. But, you know, international news media, local news media doesn't cover these tools, these resources that we have at this disposal to see the other side, that yeah, not everything is doomsday scenarios. Like, there's possible ways to transform and evolve as people, as societies, and as world, you know, as the world. What are some ways that people can follow your work? Where can they find your book? Do you have any upcoming courses or coming classes? How can people reach you?
First of all, I want to respond to what you're saying, because I want to thank you for reminding us for those spaces where beautiful things and magical things and hope and possibility are happening. And thank you for mentioning that my book is definitely, or for seeing that my book is my attempt to contribute to that. And now these days, my colleague has read my book, and whenever we, because we are obviously concerned and wanting to fight for social justice, but we always say, oh, this is feminist enchantment. So whenever we find joy in our activities, we label it, oh, feminist enchantment. So you are absolutely right. And that is why that practice, feminist enchantment. And that is the practice that I mentioned. We need to practice that daily. Because otherwise, it is going to be very hard to live in this era of magnified pain and to not have certain tools to remember the spaces that is inspiring, that is magical, that is hopeful, all of this enchantment. So thank you for that. And to answer your question, I have to add to that too, that your work, this podcast, is also part of that work, that
dream.
with inspiration, with hope, with possibility. So thank you for this work. Thank you for your labor. I appreciate that. Okay, so now going to your last question. They can find my book on Amazon, or if they live in the United States, they can go directly to the publisher. It is nyupress.org. So that's New York University Press. They can put discount code NYUP 30. So that's that's short for NYU Press, NYUP number 3 and the number and then 0. That gives people 30% off and free shipping over $40. Form on my website is DR, that's short for doctor, and then my last name, saraswati.com. So that's DRSARASWATI.com.
Any upcoming events? Will you do a book tour? People can follow you live?
So, I just did a book talk, I think it was 2 weeks ago in Seattle. I do not have anything planned right now. I'm actually going to take another year off because the book was actually written in 2017, 2018. So it's been a long time. And we all know how book takes forever to be written and then get published. So I don't want people to think, what? Like she's taking like year off all the time. So no, it has been a while since I did that. And I would love to do another travel to take that mental health break that we all need to maintain our sanity in some ways. Again, living in this pain-filled world. So
we will be featuring on the description box of this episode all the links and all the information to Dr. Ayu's book. And I invite everybody to check out all her work. We are also going to be listing the website as well as recommended articles written by herself, as well as the previous book that she launched. I invite everybody to check it out. And Dr. Ayu, thank you so much for joining the podcast. It was incredible to have you here.
Well, thank you again for this opportunity. And again, for the work that you're doing and for your and everyone's support. I hope everyone can live with pain in a way that is more enchanting and nourishing for us all.
That's it for today's episode. Please let us know your feedback and any reflections that you have on this topic and others. You can follow us on social media on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram at womenhood_IR. Thank you so much for tuning in and talk to you soon.